And please turn, if you will, to Isaiah chapter 15. 8 to 10-year-olds are dismissed to their class if they'd like to go there. Happy Mother's Day to you mothers. I hope you're not cooking today. Or if you do like cooking and you cook, I own food. Mothers are certainly a gift to us all. We're thankful for them. We know that some of you, when the topic of Mother's Day comes up, there's difficulty brought with that topic, maybe because of your own mother or for other reasons, but it's good to be reminded on a day like today that the instincts God gives ladies in general is a blessing to us all. The caring and nurturing, the love, the gentleness, the kindness, the truth that God gives all ladies is an encouragement to all. Our church is better off for you ladies being in this church. This world is better off. So we praise the Lord for his wisdom and wiring us how he wires us and making us who he makes us. Isaiah 15 to 16 is our text for the morning. I'm going to read, starting off from Isaiah 15, 1 through verse 2 of chapter 16, just to get us going, and then we'll cover the rest as we go. Isaiah 15, starting in verse 1, an oracle concerning Moab. Because Ar of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. He has gone up to the temple and to Dibon, to the high places to weep. Over Nebo and over Medeba, Moab wails. On every head is baldness, every beard is shorn. In the streets they wear sackcloth, on the housetops and in the squares everyone wails and melts in tears. Heshbon and Elilah cry out, their voice is heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles. My heart cries out for Moab. Her fugitives flee to Zoar and Eglath Shelishiah, for at the ascent of Luhith, they go up weeping on the road to Horonaim. They raise a cry of destruction. The waters of Nimrim are a desolation, and grass is withered. The vegetation fails. The greenery is no more. Therefore, the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up, they carry away over the brook of the willows. For a cry has gone out around the land of Moab. Her wailing reaches to Eglaim. Her wailing reaches to Beerlim, for the waters of Dibon are full of blood. For I will bring upon Dibon even more, a lion for those of Moab who escape, for the remnant of the land. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah by way of the desert to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. Like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. I've entitled this message, Weeping and Wailing. You know this, when someone dies and there's a funeral or a coming together, there are a lot of things happening around the death of a person. Some people it's extreme sorrow or missing. Some people there's anger and confusion for whatever reason. Some people have all different kinds of emotions that they can't even identify. A lot happens at the death of a person. All emotions kind of come out. I'm reminded of that when I think of these two chapters. In chapters 15 and 16, Moab is being judged for their pride, for their arrogance, for their wickedness. And there's a lot happening with different groups of people in these two chapters. In these two chapters, we learn about how Moab themselves deal with this judgment. We also learn, as we'll see starting in chapter 16, verse 3, we also learn about how the people of God are to respond when the wicked are being judged. And we get a window into how God feels about this judgment. There's a lot happening and a lot for us to understand when we look at the judgment of Moab. Moab's judgment and death are coming. How will they respond? How should the people of God respond when the wicked die? How should, or how does, God respond when he judges the wicked? So for our outline this morning, we're going to look at three realities that surround the judgment of the wicked. Three realities that surround the judgment of the wicked. And remember, we, as soon as we hit chapter 13, we got into judgment territory, judgment of the nations. And God is going nation after nation and telling them why and how he's going to judge them. But all throughout there are lessons for the people of God. There are things to see about our God. There are things that we are called to even do in light of his judging the wicked. So these chapters are extremely instructive for us. So three realities that surround the judgment of the wicked. Here's the first reality, the wicked wail. W-A-I-L, the wicked wail. Here we see over and over again the idea of crying, wailing, weeping come up as Moab is being judged. I often do this for you. I kind of read through and show you all the repeated words. There's a reason for that, because that's what God's trying to get you to focus on. That is the theme of what's happening here. And so, again, notice the weeping in 15:1 through 16:2. Verse 2, he has gone up to the temple, to Dibon, to the high places, to weep. This is the person being judged. They're trying to go to the temples of their gods because they're being judged. Maybe their gods will protect them, but they're going and they're weeping because judgment has come. Over Nebo and over Medeba, Moab wails. Verse 3, in the streets they wear sackcloth, mourning language. And on the housetops and in the squares, everyone wails and melts in tears. Heshbon and Elilah cry out. Their voice is heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles. Even the soldiers are crying out. You know, soldiers don't normally cry. These are. They're crying out, and it's more than that. We learn why their soul cries, why their mouth cries out, because their soul's trembling. Soldiers are afraid of the living God. Soldiers are afraid of the judgment of the living God when he comes after them in his right judgment. Everyone's wailing. Everyone's weeping. And then in verse 5, my heart cries out for Moab. Now that's interesting. Someone else is crying. Someone else is weeping. Is this Isaiah? Nope. If it is Isaiah, it's Isaiah saying this because it is God saying this. Well, how do you know it's God? I mean, I don't really like the idea of God crying. How do you know it's God? How do you know this isn't Isaiah? Well, because notice again what it says, my heart cries out. Now go down to verse 9. Same person talking here. For the waters of Dibon are full of blood, for I will bring upon Dibon even more. My heart cries out, I will bring forth more judgment. God's saying both of those things. We'll get to that more at the end of our passage, but just notice the crying going on. At the end of verse 5, they go up weeping on the road. Verse 8, for a cry has gone out around the land of Moab. Her wailing reaches to Eglaim. Her wailing reaches to Beer Elim. Weeping is what's happening in Moab. This is what God gives to Isaiah to write to his people and then to be preserved down to us. We are supposed to understand that when people are judged for their wickedness and pride, they will wail. They might put up a front for a time. If I go to hell, I'm just going to go party with my friends. You will wail one time. There will be a point where you start wailing. And that's what's being communicated here. Even the strongest in the land, the soldiers, are crying out. And then chapter 16, verse 1, send the lamb to the ruler of the land. This is instruction from God to Moab. I'm going to destroy you. In fact, back in at the beginning of the passage, 15:1, because Ar of Moab is laid waste at night, Moab is undone. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste at night, Moab is undone. The idea here is there have been some attacks on different cities in Moab, and they happened in a night, and in a night they fell. This is kind of our what we know now today as shock and awe. God has destroyed these nations in a night. That's why everyone is looking around thinking, we were strong, and now all of our cities have been decimated in a 24-hour period. And that's why there's weeping and wailing. There's dead all around them, and it happened quickly. It happened quickly, and it was broad. Over 12 place names in this passage. 12 different places all around Moab fell immediately. God's not messing around here, and his enemies are dying instantly. That's why there's the wailing. That's why there's the weeping. And again, 15:2, he's gone up to the temple. They're running where they know to run. Where do the wicked run when God is judging them? To their idols. And that's what they're doing. And notice, those idols don't satisfy. They don't save. They don't wipe the tears away. He's gone up to the temple to be on to the high places to weep over Nebo and over Medeba. Moab wails. It's not working. The idols aren't listening. They're not saving. Again, there's this crying out, crying out, crying out. And in fact, if you go down to 15:5, middle of 15:5, for at the ascent of Luhith, they go up weeping. They're going to the high places. They're going to worship their idols. On the road to Horonim, they raise a cry of destruction. The waters of Nimrim are a desolation. They're fleeing catastrophe in cities, and they're going out to countrysides where there are even water. At least they can hide there and have sustenance, but notice the waters are dried up. There's literally no hope for them. The grass is withered. There's no place to bring livestock so that they can eat, so then you could evidently feed on them. There's nothing. Everything is dying. The vegetation fails. The greenery is no more. Therefore, the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up, they carry away over the brook of the willows. It's the picture of what they have. They're carrying with them to try to provide for themselves. They're refugees. They flee. They're being judged by God, and they flee, and they can only keep what they can carry. Their animals that come with them can't find grass. They can't find water. This is a tragic scene. That's why all the crying and all the wailing. Now to 16. 16:1. God is saying to them, send the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah by way of the desert to the mount of the daughter of Zion. That's Jerusalem. So notice what God's telling Moab to do. Send a lamb to Jerusalem. Now that makes sense to the original readers. To us, we're thinking, how in the world is that supposed to help? Well, as I mentioned before, there are times when people who were subjugated or ruled over would send their wealth to other nations to appease them. Or in this case, Jerusalem, would you allow our refugees to come to you? Here are some lambs. Moab had sheep. They had plenty of sheep. So God is saying, send what you have, send your sheep to Jerusalem as the price so that they will bring in your refugees. Tell them you need them and offer them your offering, is what God's telling Moab. So here's a little bit of a bright spot. God is hinting to Moab, God is telling Moab, there's a place to go. Go to Jerusalem. Send the lamb. Bring your livestock. Let them care for you. I mean, isn't it interesting that the soldiers are crying? They think, let's escape the cities. They're burned. They're full of blood. Let's go out to the countryside. Nope. The water's dried up. Well, at least our cattle can feed over. Nope. There's no more grass. There's nowhere to go. But God says, send a lamb to Jerusalem. Send your refugees to Jerusalem. God's pointing to the fact that where he resides is a place they could go for safety. It's fascinating. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah by the way of the desert to the mount of the daughter of Zion. Like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab at the fords of Arnon. You might see pictures even today when there's conflict in certain nations and you see these long caravans of women and children trying to go for safety to another nation, to another place. And here, the women of Moab, the daughters of Moab, are fleeing. You would imagine this would mean they're with their children as well. They're the refugees, and they're dispersed. Paul House, one writer on Isaiah, said this, "More reason to lament can hardly be imagined." I mean, this is as bad as it gets. The wicked wail. The lesson for us is to see that when you oppose God, it will lead to tragedy, to wailing, to weeping, to no other salvation found in anybody else. Jesus talked the same way. When he came and spoke, Matthew 13, he warned those that if they would continue on in their sin, if they would continue to forsake the salvation he offered, they would be thrown into the fiery furnace where there is weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Isaiah 15 is the Old Testament version of that. Weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Everyone who does not embrace the salvation that God offers will one day and for eternity weep and wail and gnash their teeth. Odds are some in this room. And I pray it is not so. Today's a pretty important day to hear this passage. God offers salvation, but it's not offered forever. And if we reject, there's weeping and there's wailing. The wicked wail. There's a second reality that surrounds the judgment of the wicked, and that concerns the people of God. Secondly, God's people welcome. God's people welcome in the spiritual refugees that come to God for help. That's what we do. We are people who didn't save ourselves. God covenanted and committed to us his love. And now when people turn from their idols, turn from their wicked ways, turn from their other sources of salvation, and they turn to our God, we welcome them in because we've been welcomed in. See the passage Pastor Josh read earlier to us, Romans 15, 1-7. God's people provide a place of refuge for the wicked who have turned to God. Let me say that again. God's people provide a place of refuge for the wicked who've turned to God. Notice what the people of God are told to do. So remember the end of our last point. God's saying, there is one place you can go. Send a lamb to Jerusalem. Have your refugees go there. Now, what are the people of God told to do once those refugees come in, those spiritual refugees? Verse 3 of chapter 16, give counsel to them. Some people think this could have been, tell these refugees from Moab what the nation of Judah plans to do about Moab, or maybe it's just lead them in the way of the Lord. But you're giving them information that helps them. Give counsel, grant justice, do what's right by them. Be honest, care for them. Look to right wrongs. Give counsel, grant justice, make your shade like night at the height of noon. We were in Phoenix yesterday as a family, and we were so thankful to come home to Prescott. It is hot down there. So this passage rings true. Make your shade like the night at the height of noon. When they are suffering the most, you give them shade and comfort, is what God's telling his own people. Shelter the outcast. So it's not just provide them comfort, but now shelter is a protection for them. So provide them comfort, but also protect them. And that leads into the next exhortation. Do not reveal the fugitive. The leaders of Moab are going to come knocking for their people. Hey, we hear some of our people left and came over here. We want them back. And God's telling his people, do not extradite them. Do not send them back to those wicked rulers. Do not do that. This is interesting because I know it's been 7 days since we looked at the passage before, but the passage before happens right before our passage. It's not meant to for you to have 7 days in between. But notice how the passage ended last week. Go down to chapter 14, verse 32. So Philistia is being judged. Philistia has an idea, hey, let's work with Judah and we could kind of protect one another. And so the Philistines come to people at Judah and say, hey, let's work something out. What will Judah say? What should they say? What will one answer the messengers of a nation? What will you answer Philistia when they have an idea on how to kind of avoid judgment? Here's what you should answer. The Lord has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge. No thanks worldly ways to avoid judgment. My God has made a relationship with me. He's my refuge. So we ended last week on the idea that God is a refuge for his people. Now we come to another group of people that are being judged, and some of them may actually flee to the true and living God. And so what do God's people do who have found refuge in him? What do God's people do for those spiritual sojourners? God's people provide the refuge. So to say that God is a refuge is absolutely true, but that is meant to be communicated through the people of God as those who are in spiritual need find a refuge with the people of God. Fascinating connection here, movement here through Isaiah. God's a refuge for his people. And guess what? Their enemies who will need to come to God. They will come to the true refuge. And the people of God, who themselves have found refuge, are meant to give those people refuge. I've been cared for, protected by God. I want to extend that care and protection for you. Give counsel, grant justice, make your shade like night at the height of noon. Shelter the outcast, do not reveal the fugitive. Let the outcasts of Moab sojourn among you. Let them be part of you, live among you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer. This is the spiritual picture of what it looks like for someone to become a new follower of Christ and to join a community of believers. You've been being destroyed by the destroyer from Satan, from the world. Now you've run to the refuge that is Jesus Christ. He's saved us. Come home. Come to us. Let us care for you. It's interesting that, you know, if you read commentaries and you look at chapters 13 through 20, it's going to kind of largely say judgment on the nations. And that's true. Here it's Moab. But there are instructions in that for the people of God. You welcome in those that are running to God from judgment. And that's not just an Old Testament concept. All throughout the New Testament as well. Continuing in verse 4, when the oppressor is no more and destruction has ceased, and he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land. So when Moab and her leaders are judged, then a throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness. So this is the message to the people that are fleeing Moab. You've got your king. You've got your leaders. They've been destroyed. They're wicked. They're arrogant. They're God haters. But if you run to the true and living God, you will be under a new king. A new king who comes in the line of David. You notice that? A new king who comes and who has the tent of David. He will judge. He will do what's right. He will seek justice. And he's swift to do righteousness. This is the king that you want to be under. And notice, that whole throne, his whole reign is established, saturated by the foundation of it being steadfast love. This king loves his people. Remember earlier on when it said, don't reveal the fugitive? And I told you it's the idea of these Moabite leaders coming for their own people. Hey, they're ours. And God tells his people, don't give them over. No, you hold on to them. Don't let them go back to those leaders. You learn about the leaders of Moab. Ruthless, hateful, just like the rest of the leaders of the world. But there is a king that we serve, whose throne is established in steadfast love. This is a king who rules in such a way that he loves his people, and he does what's right by them. Friends, that is Jesus Christ for us. He loves his people. Our king loves us, and his throne is established in love, and he does what's right, and we seek to welcome people to his rule, under his care. The history of Moab is pretty fascinating. Moab's the name of the son of the oldest of Lot's daughter. And the father of that son is Lot himself. The daughters of Lot got him drunk, lay with him. One produced a son named Moab. Moab and Israel have an interesting relationship with one another. People of Moab, as Israel was entering the promised land, did not want them to enter the promised land, tried to keep them away from what God had planned for them. Moab is east of Jerusalem, wanted to keep them from the promised land. They wouldn't help Jerusalem enter their land. In fact, you can read about this in Numbers. The king of Moab wanted to curses to be rained down on this people of God. Later on in Israel's history, Moab lured Israel into Baal worship. It's an interesting relationship these two people groups have. And many of you know the story of Ruth, who was herself from Moab. And it's such a wonderful picture when Ruth has no more. Kind of like what's happening in Isaiah 15. When Ruth has no more, she attaches herself to Naomi, who is part of the people of God. Your God will be my God, Ruth says. Your people will be my people. It's a beautiful picture of what it should look like even today when people have tried everything else, they're being judged, life is hard, life is difficult, their sin is a problem, and they finally turn to the true and living God, and the people of God say, welcome in. Come in. We will provide you the refuge that he has provided us. It's a great picture of how God cares for the spiritual refugee. In fact, I want to read this from the book of Ruth. Ruth chapter 2. Ruth meets Boaz. Boaz, part of the people of God. And notice how Ruth is now provided for by the people of God. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them." So be one of our workers. You don't need to be a sojourner that just gets the leftovers. Come be part of our people who are doing the work and getting their food. Come be part of us is what's happening. "Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you so the people of God don't harm a new person that's come to them? They don't mistreat them. The men are not to touch this woman, do them harm. And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you've left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." God is a refuge for the spiritual wanderer who comes to him. God is a refuge for the people who've been apart from his people, but who are now are turning to him. And so God is a refuge, but notice Boaz getting the community. Ladies, guys, ladies, provide for her. Care for her, she's one of you. Guys, don't touch her, but give her some water. Notice God gives a refuge to these people, but the people of God also are a refuge in the name of God for these people. It's a beautiful picture. Ruth was from Moab. Certainly connections here. to Isaiah 15. So God's people welcome those spiritual refugees. This is why it's so important to be kind at church. And that might seem like, oh, of course. No. People come here looking for answers. People come wanting to hear from God. They don't come because of me and my thoughts. They come to hear from God. And so it's incumbent upon all of us to make that a place for them that provides comfort, protection, care. Come sit with me. Come learn with me, and then come to lunch with me after. The people of God extend hospitality. When others are on the run, when people are in need, we extend a love, a welcome, a hospitality. Again, you can see these truths in the New Testament. You see them in the Old. This is who God is. He's a refuge for the people that turn to Him. And so His people are a refuge to people that turn to God. You hear these horror stories as pastors sometimes of people visiting a church. It's their first time. They sit in a seat, and then a family comes, and they stare down that person, meaning to communicate, "You're where I normally sit." It would be funny if it wasn't true, but it is tragically true. That kind of stuff is, and I'm not using hyperbole here, wicked. We don't do that. We extend hospitality and love. It is better that I sit somewhere I'm uncomfortable so that you can be comfortable than it is for me to demand my rights and say, "You don't belong here." We cannot do that. Which is why I'm so thankful for even the greeters ministry at this church. I think it's so important for people to walk in and see a smiling face, a warm welcome. Brothers and sisters, this is who we've been remade to be. The old you was the one that demanded your seat. The new you is the one that says, "How can I make you comfortable? What can I do?" Welcome. I've received a welcome from the true and living God. I welcome you here. I remember being so encouraged in the early years of our church, and I don't remember all the details, but I was thinking about it in light of this passage. In the early years of our church, there was something going on in the world where there were some Christians being persecuted. I can't remember the nation. A number of them were actually coming to Phoenix. So it was in the Middle East somewhere. There's a group of Christians being persecuted. A number of them came to Phoenix. There were people in this church that reached out, made phone calls to try to see if we could welcome some of those Christians into our homes here in Prescott. And I remember at the end of the day, it was much easier for those refugees to be in Phoenix, easier to get around there, closer to the airport, more jobs there. But I remember thinking of families that were doing that and thinking how grateful I was for that example. Willing to open their homes to care for their brothers and sisters they didn't even know who needed refuge. I'm not surprised by that. That has been the testimony of some of you, many of you, so often in this church. Extending hospitality, a place to sleep, meals, care, counsel, time, a home. Just a couple weeks ago, I heard a firsthand testimony of a pastor who baptized a new believer. She was formerly Hindu, and just within the last couple months, she had turned to Christ, and her family told her, "If you go through with this baptism and this commitment to Jesus Christ, you will no longer have a family." And this lady told her pastor, her new pastor, and the people that led her to the Lord, they were in a room together, she said, "I need to know that you will be my family." Now, they did. They welcomed her in. And I think all of us, if a lady came and said that, or if a guy came and said that to us today, we'd say, yes. But we need to make sure that our actions follow our words. And like we learned in like we've learned before in the book of James, that our love isn't just something that we say, it's also something that we do. So, friends, continue being the church. Excel still more. Welcome people in. Be a host. Be a refuge. Care for people in need. This is what the people of God are to do when judgment is falling on the wicked. Some of the wicked will actually turn to God, and they should be welcomed by God's people. When God judges the wicked wail. God's people welcome. Third and finally, the judge weeps. God will execute his judgment. He is good and right to do so. If he didn't, there'd be a problem. If God let things go, he would not be a good God. He will judge. But he is also a God who weeps as he judges. Verse 6, I wonder if Moab will take God up on this offer. They don't. Verse 6, we've heard of the pride of Moab, how proud he is of his arrogance, his pride and his insolence, his idle boasting. He is not right. So Moab is rejecting the offer of salvation from God. They won't humble themselves. They are proud. They are arrogant. They boast about who they are, but notice, they're not right about it. You are not as strong as you think you are. You cannot save yourself like you think you can. You cannot do it. Therefore, let Moab wail for Moab. Salvation was offered. But when rejection, when that's met with rejection, it only leads to wailing, to judgment. Let everyone wail. Mourn, utterly stricken, for the raisin cakes of Kir Harosheth, raisin cakes, aphrodisiacs. People aren't having babies in Moab. Life isn't happening in Moab. There's judgment here. For the fields of Heshbon languish, the vine of Sibmah, the lords of the nations have struck down its branches, which reached to Jazer, and strayed to the desert. Its shoots spread abroad and passed over the sea. Moab used to have quite a large landmass, is what this is saying. And that's true. Quite a large landmass. They had a huge territory, like a vine, spread all over. Now nations are trampling that vine. Again, the picture here, being the spiritual thing to understand, when you reject God, it doesn't lead to life. It doesn't lead to flourishing. Verse 9, therefore, I will weep with the weeping of Jazer. This is God talking again. This is striking. Therefore, I will weep with the weeping of Jazer for the vine of Sibmah. I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and O Elilah. For over your summer fruit and the harvest shout has ceased. Normally, when there's a harvest, you celebrate. Where I grew up in Manteca, California, we celebrated every year the pumpkin festival. We have pumpkins. Let's ride on sketchy rides and pay a lot of money for games and hope to win prizes. You celebrate when you've got a harvest. The school I went to, the town I grew up, Ripon, California, the Almond Blossom Festival. Some of you know these festivals. You celebrate the harvest. They're not celebrating because there is no harvest. And God's not mocking, he's weeping that. That's not how it's supposed to be. For over your summer fruit and your harvest, the shout has ceased. Verse 10, and joy and gladness are taken away from the fruitful field. And in the vineyards, no songs are sung. No cheers are raised. No treader treads out wine in the presses. I have put an end to the shouting. So notice, God is weeping, but he's also the one judging. Both of those things make God glorious. You take one of those away, he is less glorious. If he's just judging, doesn't care, who cares about you? That doesn't show the glory of God. That's not what he's like. But if you think, oh, God is so kind, he doesn't want any to perish, but so maybe he just won't judge. You don't want that either. Because sin destroys, and God, you want God to put an end to that. So our wonderful God judges rightly. He never judges wrongly. He always judges appropriately. And he weeps when he has to judge and bring damnation to those that deserve it. Therefore, I weep, verse 9, with the weeping of Jazer. Notice verse 11. Therefore, my inner parts moan like a lyre for Moab. You play sad songs when you're sad. And God's saying, my heart feels like that. My inner parts moan like a lyre for Moab. And my inmost self for Kir Hareseth. And when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself on the high place, when he comes to the sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail. This isn't God's sanctuary. We get the clue there that it's on the high place. This is where idols are worshipped. So Moab, God told Moab, send the lamb, send your refugees to Jerusalem. They'll find comfort there. People of Jerusalem, people of Judah, welcome them in. The people of Moab say, no thanks. We'll stick with our own gods. And they go up to those mountains day after day after day after day to those idols. And notice the language, verse 12, when they do this, they weary themselves. Hoping for salvation in anything other than God makes you spiritually weary over and over and over and over again. And there is no peace and there is no hope. They weary themselves on the high place. Verse 13, this is the word that the Lord spoke concerning Moab in the past. But now the Lord has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt. In spite of all his great multitude and those who remain will be very few and feeble. This is saying, God's warned Moab before. Again, go to Numbers 22. He's warned them before. But now it's to the point where they've rejected him yet again. And the destruction's coming soon, within a few years. The judge weeps. He will judge, and he also weeps over it. I mean, strong language God's using in this passage, right? Therefore, I weep with the weeping of Jazer. Again, 11, my inner parts moan. In Ezekiel 33, God said this to the prophet Ezekiel, say to them, as I live, declares the Lord, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn back from your evil ways. Why will you die, O house of Israel? Now he's talking to the people of Israel that are rejecting him. I don't take pleasure in having to punish you. Turn back, turn back. And live. Again, notice the death and life pictures here. When you reject God, it leads to destruction, desolation. When you turn to God, there's life there. Take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Turn back and live. Jesus himself, being the greatest way to understand God, Jesus showing us as God himself what God is like, Jesus said this in Luke 16, nearing the end of his life, looking over Jerusalem, and we get this, Luke 16, I've turned to the wrong passage. I'll find it for you another time. I'll summarize. Jesus looking over Jerusalem and saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets. I came to you. I would have gathered you under my wings, but you would not have it. He offered refuge, and they rejected. The text says that he weeps over Jerusalem. So our God judges and he weeps as he does. I think it's important, if you're here and you're not a Christian, if you have stiff-armed God and his salvation, which he so graciously has offered, I hope you'll see the things that have been true of Moab in this passage. They're proud, but they're not right. Their joy will be taken. They weary themselves in looking for salvation in other places, and they will not prevail. I think of the hymn, I often think in hymns. Come ye sinners, poor and needy, lost and ruined by the fall. If you tarry, if you wait, if you tarry till you're better, you will never come at all. Now's the time. Jesus Christ himself came to be destroyed, to receive judgment on your behalf. We all deserve judgment. We're all Moab. We're all proud. But Jesus Christ came to receive that judgment in our place and to give us life, abundance, eternal life, a relationship of peace with God himself. I hope that you'll believe that today. Stake your life on that. Stake your eternity on that. There's proof that he offers this life. 3 days later, he rose from the dead. Trust him, and that'll be your pattern. Go to him. Have him deal with your sins on the cross. Live again, spiritually and physically, through him. And for us as Christians, this is important. This is an important passage for us, isn't it? Sometimes we get so upset at the wickedness of the world, rightly so, rightly so. It destroys. And when we hear of the wicked being judged, we celebrate it in a cold way. I think it's good to say they got what they deserved. They had rejected God. And it breaks my heart. It breaks our heart. That's the godly response. Judgment is right. And it is so sad. I think of McShane, Robert Murray McShane. He had a friend tell him, I preached on hell last Sunday. Kind of said it in a triumphant way. And McShane said, brother, I hope you did it through tears. That reflects the heart of God in this passage. Hell is real. There's weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. And it breaks the heart that that will be the end for some. I'll end with this line from Come Ye Sinners. Feel him prostrate in the garden. We never sing this line, but it's such a good line. Feel him prostrate in the garden. So see Jesus. Feel that he was on the ground in the garden because he knew he was about to suffer the wrath of God in the place of sinners. Feel him prostrate in the garden. On the ground your maker lies. On the bloody tree, behold him. Sinner, will this not suffice? It will. The death of Jesus is enough to save you from judgment. Let's pray. Thank you for being beautiful. Father, make your church, make us more like you. A willing refuge for people in need, for people who turn to you. A people that give counsel, give justice, our shade, our shelter, who protect. Make us increasingly like you, Lord. So we say thank you for being the refuge for us. We ask you to help us be a refuge for one another. And we also ask that even today people would turn to you for salvation. I pray this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.